This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Enjoy. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. 1 year ago this week, rain and floodwaters coursed through Vermont communities, from Montpelier to Barrie to Ludlow to Hardwick and many more. The floods destroyed hundreds of homes and businesses and led to two deaths. They also renewed the urgency around preparing for future natural disasters and the worsening effects of climate change. This week, Vermont Edition and the Vermont Public Newsroom are looking back on the summer 2023 floods, 1 year later. We're checking in with people we spoke to last year in the wake of the disaster. We're also looking forward. We'll have stories about farms that changed their business models, people who moved their homes or their businesses, and local leaders who are making our communities and our landscape more resilient. But first, let's look back and reflect on the past year. That's the focus of today's show. We're joined for the full hour today by my colleague, Bob Kinzel. Bob, so glad that you're with us.
Michaela, great to be here.
What does it feel like for you to be hitting this 1 year anniversary of the flooding?
You know, it's one of those situations where, you know, you think, has it really been a year? And then at the same time, wow, it seems like a long, long time. So it's both those reactions at the same time and just amazing to walk around downtown and realize, wow, it's been a year, and to remember what it looked like just a year ago. I mean, it was a war zone.
All right. Well, we want to hear from you, Bob, about what you saw last year in Montpelier, your hometown, where you've lived for many decades, and what it's like today. Bob, this week is a very different weather forecast compared to what the state faced exactly this time last year. When the water started coming down, flowing in Montpelier, what are some of your earliest memories?
Michaela, one of my early memories is how fast everything happened. We were expecting a lot of rain, and of course we'd had a couple of weeks before that where there was a lot of rainfall, so the ground was very saturated. And then the rain came, and the initial report from City Hall was, it's going to be bad, but it's not going to be as bad as Irene was back in 2011. And that turned out to be a wrong forecast because the rain just stayed right over the city. It was just a stagnant front that didn't move anywhere. And, you know, I remember we have an office here at the Capitol Plaza Hotel on State Street, and we have some windows that look out at the parking lot. And the parking lot is kind of like a little inundated area. So it's got sort of the bottom of the parking lot is probably 2 or 3 feet below street level. And at about 4 o'clock that afternoon, my colleague Pete Hirschfeld and I looked out and we saw the parking lot sort of becoming a small pond. And we thought, uh-oh, we better get our cars out of here, you know, just in case it'd be a good idea to move them. So we moved them to higher ground on East State Street. And by the time we came back, State Street itself was closed and there was maybe an inch or two of water on the street. And I thought, you know, I should get a picture of this. And I'm notorious for leaving my phone in the office and not having it on me. That's a big joke in the news department.
It is.
In any case, I said, I got to go get my phone and take a picture of State Street being closed. And when I did and I came back, well, now they're like 3 or 4 inches of water. And I'm thinking, wow, this is happening fast. And we got back to the office. And at this point, the parking lot is filling up with water. It's maybe 4:30, 5 o'clock. It seems like things are really, really going to be serious. And some of the cars in the parking lot are actually almost submerged in water. So Pete and I are saying, boy, that was a good idea to leave. And so then things just happened quickly. You know, it went from 3 or 4 inches of water to 3 or 4 feet. I think, Michaela, that I might have been the last person out of the hotel that night. It was about 8:30. I'd gotten off the air. I went to the front entrance of the hotel just to see how much water there was on State Street, looking across at the movie theater, the Capitol Theater. And the water was already up to the top stair at the hotel. Now, to give listeners an idea, that's about 3.5 feet, 4 feet. And I thought, whoa, this is bad.
Did you feel scared? Yeah.
I wasn't scared. I knew I could spend the night at the hotel if I had to. I mean, I was scared for Montpelier. Personally, I was not scared for my safety because I knew I could, if I had to, I could sleep in the office. And there was, as I looked out there, the former owner of the hotel, and this is just an amazing story, the hotel was sold, closed, 5 days before the flood. So the new owners had been here less than a week. Hmm. And the former owner was in the main office at the hotel and said, Bob, if you want to get out of here, here's a back way to higher ground by using a back entrance that I think you can make. And there was about 1.5 feet of water there, but it was stagnant water, so I wasn't dealing with moving water. And I was able to go out there, get wet, but I could make it to higher ground and then make it on the bike path home.
Wow.
But it was a scary experience to think that this much water was downtown. And at the time, you're thinking very short term. You're not thinking, oh, what's happening to all the businesses? What's happening to all the residences? It's just sort of dealing in the moment. And then when I got up on the bike path and I could look back at the city, it was a staggering and a very sobering sight.
Ugh. Well, listeners, if you are also being taken back to those early moments of the flood, when you realize, hey, this is something very different, this is something out of the ordinary for me, for my family, for my community, you can call in at 800-639-2211. Bob, you mentioned the shock of watching the waters rise so quickly. Our next guest, Colin O'Neill, also had a similar experience over at the Wrightsville Dam. It was one of the dams that threatened to have water spill over, which would have been an unprecedented situation. Officials at one point were suggesting that Montpelier residents seek shelter in the upper floors of their homes. And Colin was there the whole time. He's the Wrightsville Recreation District Manager, where he's worked for more than 20 years, one of the people monitoring water levels at the dam. Colin, welcome.
Hi.
Well, thanks so much for being here with us. Can you tell us what some of your earliest memories were when you started to look at those water levels at the dam and say, hey, this is very out of the ordinary?
Yeah, well, so we deal with flooding regularly there because that's why that park exists, is because it's behind the flood prevention Wrightsville Dam. But this was unique. I arrived there in the morning before Montpelier had flooded, to continue preparing the park for flooding. So tethering picnic tables, bringing supplies up from the park area up to our storage sheds, getting the porta potty out of there. And while bringing the porta potty out, I was in water. I was in like knee deep water at that point, and it was coming up fast. Like normally a typical flood event at the Wrightsville, the water's going to come up by maybe a foot an hour. This was coming up by 2 feet an hour. So that was really surprising. And after 20 something years managing there, unprecedented. So we were scrambling. Mm. We had half the amount of time to prepare the park before it was underwater than what we had expected. Mm. So yeah, it was a mad dash that day to get everything tethered and everything up out of harm's way. But we did a great job. Some of my crew couldn't make it in because they had experienced flooding in their houses, or roads in between their house and Wrightsville were flooded or washed away. But two crew members made it in, and we got the park pretty well battened down. And we walked away at about 1:15 that day. Hmm. And the next day it was... it was up to the road.
Yeah. What were your emotions when you were watching all of this happen? Did you have faith in the dam? Were you scared? Were you nervous?
Yeah, well, I definitely had faith in the dam. I mean, I've watched this dam cycle through floods, you know, countless times over 20 years using the USGS site that has the water surface elevation updated every hour. And if anyone's curious to see that, you can go to the Wrightsville Beach VT homepage. And at the bottom, there's a link to the USGS site and the Wrightsville page. So I was nervous about Wrightsville, but I was really nervous about Montpelier, and not that the dam would fail, but that the water would go over the secondary, aka emergency spillway, which would add volume on top of the 1200 cubic feet per second that were already coming out of the dam. You know, the unknown of what additional water would have come down over that emergency spillway.
Bob, as a Montpelier resident yourself, do you remember looking for these constant updates on the dam, worrying about what was going to happen with it?
Absolutely. It was a report that was coming out at least once an hour, if not more than that. And there was great concern. And I got to tell you, there was some confusion downtown about what it meant to have the water being released through the spillway. I don't think some folks understood what that meant. They thought it meant dam failure. And so it was, well, we're within a foot of the spillway. And people were thinking, oh, my goodness, we're a foot away from a total disaster. And so there was an educational process for people downtown to understand, what does this mean, water being released through the spillway? Because it's something that they hadn't experienced before. So it was being very closely monitored, really on an hourly basis in downtown Montpelier. And there was a lot of concern because it would go from 3 feet to 2 feet to 1 foot, maybe to 10 inches. I don't know if Colin, if it got that close, but there was like, whoa, we are on the verge here of a major disaster.
Yeah. Colin, do you remember fielding calls from people or what were the conversations like you were having at that time as the water got higher and higher?
Well, I definitely agree about the confusion at the time, and that confusion persists to this day about what that actually meant might happen. You know, there was a lot of misinformation or just misunderstanding, thinking dam failure. And that was never a concern, at least that I'm aware of. You know, it was just that the water was going to overtop that secondary spillway, which is at 684 feet above sea level. I'm sorry, 685 feet above sea level. I was working on information that I had been given years earlier that it was actually 684 feet. So that's why I was so concerned.
And that foot makes a big difference.
Huge difference. So, and Bob, yeah, you were right. It did come within 10 inches of the top of that secondary spillway. But, you know, it doesn't mean all is lost. If it goes over that, it all comes down to how much water, how much rain is falling. You know, or fell in the previous couple hours and then continues to fall. It could be just a teaspoon of additional water that goes over that secondary spillway and nothing is noticed. You know, there's already 1200 cubic feet per second coming out, another, you know, a couple cubic feet, no big deal. It's just that it's unchecked at that point. Whatever additional water flows into the reservoir flows right over that spillway. So that's where, you know, it's just an unknown. And fortunately, the rain stopped just in the nick of time, and it never topped that. And the dam performed amazingly well. I mean, it was an engineer's dream. The Army Corps of Engineers back in the 50s, they were tasked to increase the holding capacity of that dam to retain the greatest probable rain event. And it did that, like, to perfection this time around.
Has the Wrightsville Beach and Park fully recovered?
No, goodness. We've got probably two more years of recovering and then working towards implementing the resiliency plan that we actually wrote 6 years ago, somewhere around there. So we are open. We've worked on, like, outward-facing aesthetics and functionality for the public. The main road into the park was redone. A culvert failed up there. That's been replaced. the main path from the parking area down to the beach has been redone. Another culvert down there replaced. We had 50 cubic yards of new sand brought in to go right over the top of a thick layer of silt that had been deposited. My crew has been working really diligently cutting and removing all the dead trees and bushes. Because, you know, unlike Montpelier, where the floodwaters receded relatively quickly, Briceville was underwater for 3 weeks. So it killed a lot of the beautiful flora around the park. And so we continue removing that. That'll go on probably for another year. And then we're doing improvements to the park to improve resiliency and the product. So, you know, in 2 years, once everything is done, with FEMA's help, with an awesome grant that we got from the Vermont Forest Parks and Recreation, their VOREC grant, we just started a fundraising campaign that people can donate to on our website. So we're going to replace buildings with non-buoyant ones. We're switching our operations to more mobility, where we can just quickly move assets out of the flood area. So we're switching to a lot of trailers, enclosed trailers, so we can rapidly, because I was down there working for about 16 hours preparing the park for this flood, and it still wasn't enough.
Well, Colin, it sounds like you would, go ahead.
I'm sorry. So we have a ways to go, but the park looks great. So, you know, when we have beautiful days like this and this week, I really encourage people to get outside and make the most of it, because the rainy days are coming still. So let's get out there and play while we can.
Enjoy this time. Well, Colin O'Neill, the Wrightsville Recreation District Manager, thank you for all your work in Wrightsville and for joining us today.
My pleasure, Michaela. Thanks for having me.
And Bob Kinzel, we have to take a break in just a moment, but briefly here, at this legislative session, Vermont lawmakers passed a bill, Act 121, which increased permanent dam safety staff from 5 to 9 and included a bunch of other dam safety measures. What else do you know about how the legislature addressed dam safety?
Well, Michaela, it certainly put a spotlight on an issue that had not received a lot of attention before. And I think it became a key issue for many lawmakers to see what steps they could take to ensure this wouldn't happen again. As you mentioned, it increased the number of positions. It also consolidates the oversight process for hundreds of dams and puts more of them under the review of the Department of Environmental Conservation. And the law also puts more money into the revolving loan fund for dam safety. And this would be used to finance the removal of some dams that could possibly pose a threat to downstream communities. And this loan fund is also available to some private landowners. So it really puts a focus on this issue and says, you know, this is something we have not been paying enough attention to in the past, and this has got to be our primary focus going forward.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lefrak. Today on the show, we are kicking off a week of coverage looking back on the summer 2023 floods and considering what comes next for our region. We posted on Vermont Public's Instagram ahead of today's show and got a number of responses there about how the flooding impacted them. One person wrote, "I lost my job." Another person said, "When it rains and rains in central Vermont, we worry." A third wrote, "It can happen to anyone, anywhere. Life is so fragile. Be kind and love your neighbor." Our guest this hour is Bob Kinzel, Vermont Public senior reporter and a longtime resident of Montpelier. And we have some calls coming in. Let's start with Syriac from Barry City. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes, you are. Hi there.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, I was here and a little bit of my basement got flooded also. But, you know, people down the street and Farwell and Pleasant Street had a much harder time. And, one thing we know is, like, these are supposed to be once-in-a-century events. And they're kind of happening frequently. And I'm just curious to know, like, how are we holding the people who cause climate change accountable? I'm really happy that Governor Phil Scott passed the Superfund Act, but I think like that needs to happen everywhere across the United States. You know, I saw some of the comments on Facebook when this when this act was being passed and how many Vermonters were actually willing to give fossil fuel companies a pass on this. Mm-hmm. While they're making billions of dollars, we're all suffering. Like, I had to spend almost $10,000 to, like, put some pumps in my basement. And, like, why should I have to pay for these things? It doesn't seem fair to me.
Right. Who is responsible? Who pays? That is a big question here in Vermont. Thank you for your call. Bob, remind us briefly what the Climate Superfund Act is that our caller just mentioned.
Well, this is really a fascinating question about whether or not the state of Vermont can hold these fossil fuel companies responsible for the damages caused by climate change. It's going to become a national issue and lots of litigation. And, you know, it might be somewhat similar to the tobacco settlement that was made maybe 15 years ago, holding the tobacco companies responsible for the health conditions of so many Vermonters and so many people across the country. And so I think the caller really hits it of who's going to be held responsible. And, you know, I think the short-term answer is there's not a lot that's going to happen in the very short term in Vermont that can influence the national and world situation. I mean, in Montpelier, they're looking at the idea of it's not if there's going to be another big flood, it's when. And could it happen in the next 5 or 10 years? There are a bunch of people who think the answer to that question is yes. And are there steps that can be taken in terms of the climate in that time frame to make a difference? I think that's somewhat of an unknown. But there are things like we talked about dam safety, other flood mitigation steps that can be taken. And in the short term, I think there's a short term response, kind of a midterm response, and a longer term response. And it's just going to take a while for all of these to play out.
And 1 year in the grand scheme of things. It isn't that much time that's passed since these floods. Well, as we've talked about, Bob, Montpelier was hit very hard, as were many other communities, including the nearby city of Barrie. Their homes and businesses were destroyed. Basements and first floors were filled with water and toxic silt. And a man died in Barrie as a result of the flooding. He fell into the water in his basement. We're joined now by two people who were on the ground throughout all of this, trying to help their community. Michael Charbonneau is a captain with Barrie City Fire. He served there for nearly 20 years. Michael, welcome.
Good afternoon.
We're also joined by Keith Cushman, the chief of Barrie's Fire Department, a position he's been in since February 2023. Keith, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, Keith, Barrie is no stranger to flooding. Do you remember when you realized that what was going on a year ago at this time was something out of the ordinary?
Well, the big question is, what is ordinary nowadays?
Yeah.
And we flooded so many times over the past couple of decades that we have a heightened sense of awareness. And when we see that there is weather events coming that could have an impact, we begin planning. And planning for the worst and hoping for the best. And honestly, we were planning and thinking, it's not going to be that bad. It's not going to be that bad. And I think I had that feeling right up until maybe early to mid morning on Monday it's not going to hit us. But meanwhile, we still had plans in place, and we were moving equipment to higher ground, nevertheless.
Yeah. And Michael, you weren't scheduled to work the main day of the flooding, the 10th or the 11th, but you still ended up coming in, right?
Yeah, that's correct. We had a lot of indications that this was not going to be good. It was going to be out of the ordinary. And we're calling extra staff in to help out however possible with, you know, setting up things or getting things to higher ground so we could be ready in case the water did crest the river.
Hmm. And Chief Cushman, when you saw what the floodwaters and the ensuing mudslides were doing to Barrie City, I wonder if you could kind of give us a glimpse into what that felt like to see your community devastated so much by this disaster.
Yeah, so it obviously it's heart-wrenching when you see the effect that it's having on the businesses and the homeowners in the city. And also, personally, I had a feeling of disbelief that it was actually happening here in Vermont. The flooding to the magnitude and then coupled with the landslides, that's something I equate to California. Never dreamt would I see it in Vermont, let alone in Barrie, within our 4 square miles.
And Michael, you spent a month in Louisiana during Hurricane Katrina. Did last summer's flooding give you flashbacks to what you saw there?
Oh, I definitely did. It was just like Chief Cushman said, it was something I would have never expected to see here in the town I live in. It was just unreal. It reminded me a lot, just a smaller scale, a smaller area, but the levels that we had for water and the distress that people were in, the damage that was done to people's houses and businesses. And it was just something I never would have expected to see here, but it definitely kind of took me back to that that month I spent down there and just seeing the devastation on such a scale.
And did that training, that experience that you got in Louisiana help you with the work that you had to do in Barrie after the flooding last summer?
I think so. It was something that I definitely harken back to in the moment when things were going on, that sense of kind of having to work outside your comfort zone a little bit. And also just, having extra help and resources that we're used to having within a few minutes when we ask for help, that wasn't really an option for us. So many roads were closed off. We had to take very long and roundabout ways just to get to certain locations when people were calling for help. And that just knowing that some of these technical resources that we would usually have, or even just manpower, were not something that we could really rely on. It was time to kind of come together in the small groups that we had and make things happen.
Right. And Chief Cushman, speaking of rallying all those resources together, there were a number of swift water rescues in Barrie. What role did the fire department play in those?
So we were receiving the calls from those that were cut off from dry ground or high ground. And so we would relay those calls for service to our state partners, which had moved into the Berlin Firehouse prior to the storm. And they would dispatch crews from there. We were sharing those assets between Barrie and Montpelier. As you can imagine, Montpelier had a great need for them as well.
Hmm. And so much has changed in the last year, even though, a year isn't too much time, but there's been so much redevelopment in Barrie, demoing, rebuilding, and thinking about the future. And I imagine there's been change at the fire department as well, perhaps with an eye towards preparing for future events like this one. Chief Cushman, I'm wondering if there's maybe one thing that you could pull out for us about one thing that has changed in the last year for you and your department.
Boy, it's difficult to pull just one thing, to be honest. We have training that's coming up in 2 weeks to help better prepare our staff, to help the citizens. And there's a lot of things happening behind the scenes to help mitigate any future flooding as well. So I can't put my finger on any one thing. There's a lot of moving parts, and some of those are timely and are a 2 to 3 year period for implementation. So I know that doesn't really answer your question for one, but there's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, a lot going on. And Michael, for you, is there something that's changed perhaps about how you approach your work, about your connection with the community, something that's different from last July to this one?
It's definitely something that I'm more aware of, thinking outside the box and different things that might happen on calls that, you wouldn't usually plan for or expect to see. I mean, even when I was in Louisiana, they're below sea level there, so they didn't have landslides to worry about. They didn't have great big hills with just mountains and walls of mud that were taking houses off the foundation and turning them sideways, or, you know, covering four lane highways. So that was something that I wasn't really quite prepared for, but it's something that has kind of opened my eyes. I think about some of those things, about more what can possibly happen that I'm not usually expecting. And as far as the community goes, it's just really important that we all kind of stick together and help each other out, and, you know, have to have a lot of empathy or sympathy for people that have lost everything. And hopefully we can help get them funding and assistance to get back on their feet and replace what they've lost.
Michael Charbonneau is a captain with Barrie City's Fire Department, and Keith Cushman is the chief of the fire department there. Thank you both so much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome, and thank you for highlighting this this tragic day a year ago.
Yeah, well, thank you for your work in helping Barrie City rebuild. Bob, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts. Bob Kinsel, our senior reporter in Montpelier, relatively close by to Barrie City. Thoughts listening to our two guests there?
I definitely do. You know, I think Barrie City had a different experience to some degree than the city of Montpelier. And this is what I mean by that. In Montpelier, there was a lot of damage to the downtown business area, and several dozen residences also were affected. But the business area, I think, suffered more damage than the larger residential community. Over in Barrie City, it seemed to really have a huge residential impact. Now, I know the business community in downtown Barrie got hit, but I don't think it got hit as hard as Montpelier. And the flip side of that is I think the residences in Barrie got hit a lot harder than those in Montpelier. I remember being on 2nd Street in Barrie 2 days after the flood, and it was an unbelievable sight. I mean, it was one of those things where you look at it and you wonder if you're really seeing reality. I think I was in mud up to about a foot or a foot and a half. And at one point, I got stuck on 2nd Street, and I really couldn't move. I was trying to catch up to some city and state officials to do some interviews. And there were people coming out of their houses just dazed of wondering, how do we ever clean up from this mess? And I think if we went over there today, we would see some places that are still in need of desperate repair. And the city of Barrie, particularly that residential area, really got hammered, and a lot of people lost everything that they had. And it's just, It just breaks your heart to think about what people have to do to recover from something like that.
And let's go to the phones now. We have Shauna calling from Barrie. Shauna, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, everyone. Hi.
Hi. What's your question or your comment?
Hi. Oh, so, yeah, my name is Shauna Trader. I was impacted by the flood myself here in Barrie, which I'm standing on the main street of right now, so if you hear cars, forgive me. But I was the executive director of Rainbow Bridge at the time, the Rainbow Bridge Community Center. We responded, the Rainbow Relief, Rainbow Response Team. We were on the streets day zero. And now I'm the chair of Barrie Up here, and we're a long-term recovery group doing a lot of good work in Barrie City. And so I thought I might be able to share some of the stories that are going on from my perspective.
Please do. Tell us at least for now one thing that's changed in the past year for you and your work.
Let's see. When the floodwaters rose, it was a catastrophe of disconnection. Someone mentioned a few minutes ago, it might have been the fire folks from Barrie City, that everything was disconnected and difficult to get to. It really cut off our neighborhoods from each other, and it cut off our main streets from the world. And when the waters receded, it really exposed a lot of the insecurities that exist here in this town. This town is particularly affected by poverty and all of the issues that cascade down from poverty. Housing, obviously, substance abuse, and so forth. And it really became obvious after the flood how many holes there were in our social safety net and how important it has been for community members to recognize that, acknowledge that, and stand up and fight for a stronger community.
I'm wondering, Shauna, if you have a specific example or a story of seeing community members, excuse me, do just that.
So it's a matter of sharing, and if you're a child of the 80s like myself, sharing is caring. The Care Bears taught us that. For instance, someone losing a vehicle in this town could actually affect 3 or 4 households. Because you're talking about a lot of low-income and poverty-stricken folks that were impacted, like Bob Kinzel mentioned, and let me echo what he said and also add to it, that not only was that disparity present here in Barrie as far as the business owners versus the residential areas, but the side effect of all of that, an additional fact on that, is the availability of resources to recover from disaster really favor owners, whether it be property owners, business owners, or any people that have the bandwidth to call and do the applications and receive the support. And in Barrie, what we've seen is a lot of folks who are struggling so dearly that it is really an impossible task to ask them to apply a million times or return emails and phone calls in a way that makes receiving the resources possible for a lot of business and homeowners. And as you know, FEMA also, everything we have through FEMA really favors property owners. It really doesn't do a lot for tenants. And so what we've seen here in Barrie City is an incredible economic disparity and economic injustice play out as a result of this, because poor people and tenants will always have a more difficult time recovering from disaster because the resources are simply not there. So getting back to the sharing is caring thing, a single car knocked out by the flood impacted multiple homes because you had neighbors that were sharing a vehicle. You had family members that were sharing a vehicle. So now the loss of one single vehicle means that grandma doesn't get to her doctor's appointment. Your neighbor doesn't get to his job. Right. You don't get to your job. Now multiple people lose their job or are impacted health-wise. And so you can see how quickly the cascading effect of poverty really stacks up for people like that.
And Shauna, I know you're doing so much work there with Barrie Up to support people in that position. I'm sorry to have to jump in. I want to make sure we get to some other callers. That was Shauna Trader with the organization Barrie Up. Let's go to Sean in Versher next. Sean, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, totally different kind of vibe, but I was just amazed by how much of the geology of the state was exposed after being buried for years, from piles of glacial cobbles that exposed lots of really cool, like serpentine, to some of the little mountain streams that were turned into these deep gullies down to the bedrock. It was just really unique to see all those things in the destruction, kind of a bittersweet aspect to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sean, I would encourage you and other listeners interested in the geologic findings of the flood, scientists who have been looking into that, to tune in on Thursday. We're going to be joined by someone from the Nature Conservancy who has been focused on watershed restoration in the state, has some very interesting things to say about that. Thank you for calling in. We've also gotten a number of folks who've written in on Instagram about today's show. One person wrote, "Developing near a river is not a good idea. We no longer need river power." Another person wrote, "Think globally, act locally feels more important than ever before." Bob, that comment reminds me of what the caller Shauna was just saying about sharing is caring. I'm wondering if there's any moments from the past year, and I'm sure there are many, of folks in your community stepping up to help one another out that you witnessed as a reporter.
Absolutely. The response in the community was just unbelievable. From the first day, Montpelier Alive, which is a group that helps promote downtown businesses, their whole agenda had to pivot to recovery. And they had a couple of tents set up on Main Street, right by the Savoy Movie Theater. And it was incredible to see hundreds of people just lining up and coming to these tents and saying, how can I help? And Montpelier Alive folks could say, well, if you want to work for an hour, here's a store that needs some help, or here's a residence that needs some cleaning out. And people came through and donated lunches and food and water and other things. The community response was really overwhelming. And I think for a lot of folks, a lot of the business owners and residences made them feel like, you know, I got a tough, tough challenge ahead, but the community support is so strong, I feel really good about being in this community. So it was really, and this is something that lasted for days and weeks after the flood. You know, sometimes you think, well, there's going to be some community support for the first 48 hours and then it's over. But it wasn't. It stayed. And it was really heartening to watch and see.
Mm. Well, let's go back to the phone. So the time we have left, we have John in Lyme, New Hampshire, calling in. John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I work in Vermont at Norwich University in Northfield, and I'm a geologist who studies rivers and floods and flood recovery. So I thought I should give a ring.
Oh, well, what have you been thinking about right now? I'm sure you've been very busy in the past year studying the effects of the flooding in this region. What are you thinking about on this one-year anniversary?
Yeah, very much. You know, the thing that I find is that floods are really devastating for our communities and for human infrastructure, and we always have to keep that in mind. But what I see time and time again is that the floods are actually incredibly beneficial for the natural system of the rivers. It builds stability, it builds habitat diversity. Kind of, there's a saying out there in our field saying messy rivers are healthy rivers, and floods bring that messiness back. I heard someone earlier talk about how the flood was a disconnection, but in our field, the flood is a reconnection of things that aren't normally connected, floodplains connecting with the channel, and it's a huge reset that can be incredibly beneficial to our rivers, you know, no matter what size the flood. Mm. All that said, understanding how devastating the flood is for the things that we build and put and live near the rivers, and I've been impacted by that directly myself as well.
So, do you mind telling us a bit about that? How have you been impacted?
Well, I mean, not as severely as some people. I remember walking around after Tropical Storm Irene and telling some people, wow, this must have been really exciting. And then they talked about how their daughter couldn't get through her chemotherapy follow-up, and other people had to be life-flighted out. I was in California working as a naturalist for a stint, and I lost my job for 3 months. So those are some of the main things. My commute's been a lot worse after this flood, but I haven't been hit as hard as other people. But what I see on the rivers is that they're very much benefited from that. The most recent study we have is on a dam removal, and that helps the rivers in a lot of ways. A small dam that was a safety hazard, and the recovery of that the recovery process of the dam removal was accelerated by the floods last year. So it really helped it out.
Mm. Well, John, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your expertise. And again, we'll be talking more about watershed restoration specifically on our show on Thursday. Bob Kinzel, John just brought up Tropical Storm Irene in 2011. What has felt different to you about the response to these floods, the one-year anniversary, versus what you remember from Irene?
Well, I can only talk from the perspective from being in Montpelier and Barrie and Waterbury for both Irene and for part of the flood a year ago. And it just seemed like the damage was a lot worse this time to businesses and residences. In Irene, we saw, you know, whole roads washed away. And we certainly had communities, Waterbury in particular, and some down by Ludlow, that were just overwhelmed by water, and there's so much destruction. And You know, what it makes me think also, Michaela, is, you know, you watch the news over the weekend and you see this hurricane barreling down on the coast of Texas, and you see some of the video of that where places are underwater, cars are being submerged, and you realize you can feel what it meant emotionally to people in our own community and what it has meant to many folks. And you realize that same thing is unfolding there. I think it just increases our empathy for folks that are going through these natural disasters. We've been there. We've done that. We know what it feels like. And now we understand there's a whole nother group of people going through the same thing. And sort of in the background is, it's not if this is going to happen again, is when is it going to happen again? And that's kind of the unsettling thought that hangs over this first anniversary.
Right. It does indeed. Well, Bob, I want to close us out today with a song that was sent to us ahead of today's show. It's sung by Julie Ostrov and written by her wife, Kristen Plylar Moore. They live in Montpelier, and here's what Julia wrote to us. When the waters came up 7 or 8 feet into the basement, a friend graciously took us in after we materialized on her doorstep. We stayed there for a week while our landlord worked thoroughly around the clock to remediate our apartment. My wife, Kristen, a teacher and songwriter, wrote this song after we went to a Mountaineers game the following week on a clear, calm summer's eve. The song reflects both the sadness and hope for our town.
There's a brilliant moon over the town tonight. Rivers low, I can hear you sigh. Can't we pretend me, make it better, tell me everything will be all right.
That was the chorus of a song by Kristen Plylar Moore and performed by her wife, Julia Ostrov of Montpelier. It's called Brilliant Moon. Bob, I thought that was kind of a emotional and poetic way to close today's conversation with reflections. And I so appreciate you taking the time for telling us about what you remember about the week a year ago today.
It was my pleasure, Michaela.